gave birth to a child, and was then quite ill. Kristen was both her neighbor and considered the most capable healer in the region. Nakva often came over with messages and queries for his mother, and the niece, Ivor Hawkins' daughter, would always find the opportunity to meet and talk with him. Kristen wasn't pleased by this. She had taken a disliking to the maiden and didn't find her beautiful, although she had heard that most men did. She was happy on the day she learned that Ivor had returned home to Raumsdal. But she didn't think Nakva had been particularly fond of Ivor, especially when she heard that Frida kept chattering about the daughter at Loptsgard, Asta Auden's daughter, and teasing Nakva about her. One day Kristen was in the brewhouse, boiling a juniper decoction, when she heard Frida once again carrying on about Asta. Nakva was with Gauta and their father outside behind the courtyard. They were building a boat that they wanted to take up to the small fishing lake in the mountains. Erland was a moderately good boat builder. Nakva grew cross, and then Gauta began to tease him too. Asta might be a suitable match. "Ask for her hand yourself if that's what you think," said his brother heatedly. "No, I don't want her," replied Gauta, "because I've heard that red hair and pine forests thrive on meager soil. But you think that red hair is pretty." "That saying can't be used about women, my son," said Erland with a laugh. "Those with red hair usually have soft white skin." Frida laughed uproariously, but Kristen grew angry. She thought this talk too frivolous for such young boys. She also remembered that Suniva Olav's daughter had red hair, although her friends called it golden. Then Gauta said, "You should be glad I didn't say anything. I didn't dare, for fear of sin. On the vigil night of Whitsunday, you sat with Asta in the grain tithe barn all the time we were dancing on the church hill. So you must be fond of her." Nakva was about to fall upon his brother, but at that moment Kristen came outside. After Gauta had left, she asked her other son, "What was it that Gauta said about you and Asta Auden's daughter?" "I don't think anything was said that you didn't hear, mother," replied the boy. His face was red, and he frowned angrily. Annoyed, Kristen said, "It's unseemly that you young people can't hold a vigil night without dancing and leaping about between services. We never used to do that when I was a maiden." "But you've told us yourself, mother, that back when you were young, our grandfather used to sing while the people danced on the church hill." "Well, not those kinds of ballads and not such wild dancing," said his mother. "And we children stayed properly with our parents. We didn't go off two by two and sit in the barn." Nakva was about to make an angry retort. Then Kristen happened to glance at Erland. He was smiling so slyly as he eyed the plank he was about to cut with an axe. Indignant and dismayed, she went back inside the brewhouse. But she thought a good deal about what she had heard. Asta Auden's daughter was not a poor match. Loptsgard was a wealthy estate, and there were three daughters, but no son. And Ingebjörg, Asta's mother, belonged to an exceedingly good lineage. She had never thought that one day the people of Jurengard might call Auden Torbersen kinsman. But he had suffered a stroke this past winter, and everyone thought he had little time left to live. The girl was seemly and charming in manner, and clever, or so Kristen had heard. If Nakva had great affection for the maiden, there was no reason to oppose this marriage. They would still have to wait for 2 more years to hold the wedding, as young as Asta and Nakva both were. But then she would gladly welcome Asta as her son's wife. On a fine day in the middle of the summer, Sira Solman's sister came to see Kristen to borrow something. The women were standing outside the house to say their farewells when the priest's sister said, "Well, that Ivor Hawkins' daughter." Her father had driven her from his estate because she was with child, so she had sought refuge at Ulvsvold. Nakva had been up in the loft. Now he stopped on the lowest step. When his mother caught a glimpse of his face, she was suddenly so overcome that she could hardly feel her own legs beneath her. The boy was crimson all the way up to his ears as he walked away toward the main house. But Kristen soon understood from the other woman's gossip that things must have been such with Ivor long before she came to their parish for the first time in the spring. "My poor innocent boy," thought Kristen, sighing with relief. "He must be ashamed that he thought well of the girl." A few nights later, Kristen was alone in bed because Erlund had gone out fishing. As far as she knew, Nokva and Gauta had gone along with him. But she was awakened when Nokva touched her and whispered that he needed to talk to her. He climbed up and sat at the foot of her bed. "Mother, I've been out to talk with that poor woman Ivor tonight. I was sure they were lying about her. I was so certain that I would have held a glowing piece of iron in my hand to prove that she was lying. That magpie from Romengard." Kristen lay still and waited. Nokva tried to speak firmly, but suddenly his voice threatened to break with emotion and distress. "She was on her way to Matins on the last day of Christmas. She was alone, and the road from their manor passes through the woods for a long stretch. There she met two men. It was still dark. She doesn't know who they were. Maybe foresters from the mountains. In the end, she couldn't defend herself any longer, the poor young child. She didn't dare tell her troubles to anyone. When her mother and father discovered her misfortune, they drove her from home, with slaps and curses as they pulled her hair. When she told me all this, Mother, she wept so hard that it would have melted a rock in the hills." Nokva abruptly fell silent, breathing heavily. Kristen said she thought it the worst misfortune that those villains had escaped. She hoped that God's justice would find them, and that for their deeds they might suffer their just deserts on the executioner's block. Then Nokva began to talk about Ivor's father, how rich he was, and how he was related to several respected families. Ivor intended to send the child away to be raised in another parish. Gudmundar, his wife, had given birth to a bastard child by a priest, and there sat Sigrid Andrasdottir at Kruka, a good and honored woman. A man would have to be both hard-hearted and unfair to pronounce Ivor despoiled because against her will she had been forced to suffer such shame and misfortune. Surely she was still fit to be the wife of an honorable man. Kristen pitied the girl and cursed her assailants. And in her heart she gave thanks and exulted over what good luck it was that Nokva would not come of age for 3 more years. Then she told him gently to bear in mind that he should be careful not to seek out Ivor in her chamber late at night, as he had just done, or to show himself at Ulvsvold unless he had tasks for the landowner's servants. Otherwise he might unwittingly cause people to gossip even worse about the unfortunate child. It was all well and good to say that those who claimed to doubt Ivor's word and refused to believe she had landed in this misfortune without blame wouldn't find him weak in the arms. All the same, it would be painful for the poor girl if there was more talk. 3 weeks later, Ivor's father came to take his daughter home for a betrothal banquet and wedding. She was to marry a good farmer's son from her parish. At first, both fathers had opposed the marriage because they were feuding over several sections of land. In the winter, the men had reached an agreement, and the two young people were about to be betrothed, but suddenly Ivor had refused. She had set her heart on another man. Afterward, she realized it was too late for her to reject her first suitor. In the meantime, she went to visit her aunt in Seal, no doubt thinking that there she would receive help in concealing her shame, because she wanted to marry this new man. But when Hilabjörg of Ulvsvold saw what condition the girl was in, she sent her back to her parents. The rumors were true enough. Her father was furious and had struck his daughter several times, and she had indeed fled to Ulvsvold. But now he had come to an agreement with her first suitor, and Ivor would have to settle for the man, no matter how little she liked it. Kristen saw that Nokva took this greatly to heart. For days he went around without saying a word, and his mother felt so sorry for him that she hardly dared cast a glance in his direction. If he met his mother's eye, he would turn bright red and looked so ashamed that it cut Kristen to the heart. Whenever the servants at Urengard started talking about these events, their mistress would tell them sharply to hold their tongues. That filthy story and that wretched woman were not to be mentioned in her house. Frida was astonished. So many times she had heard Kristen Lavrun's daughter speak with forbearance and offer help with both hands to a maiden who had fallen into such misfortune. Frida herself had twice found salvation in the compassion of her mistress. But the few words Kristen said about Ivar Hawken's daughter were as vile as anything a woman might say about another. Erland laughed when she told him how badly Nokva had been fooled. It was one evening when she was sitting out on the green spinning, and her husband came over and stretched out on the grass at her side. "No misfortune has come of it," said Erland. "Rather, it seems to me the boy has paid a small price to learn that a man shouldn't trust a woman."
"Is that so?" said his wife. Her voice quivered with stifled indignation.
"Yes," said Erland, smiling. "Now you, when I first met you, I thought you were such a gentle maiden that you would hardly even take a bite out of a slice of cheese. As pliable as a silk ribbon and as mild as a dove. But you certainly fooled me, Kristen."
"How do you think things would have gone for all of us if I had been that soft and gentle?" she asked.
"No."
Erland took her hands, and she had to stop working. He looked up at her with a radiant smile. Then he laid his head in her lap.
"No, I didn't know, my sweet, what good fortune God was granting me when he set you in my path, Kristen."
But because she constantly had to restrain herself in order to hide her despair at Erland's perpetual nonchalance, her anger would sometimes overwhelm her when she had to reprimand her sons. Her fists would turn harsh and her words fierce. Ivar and Skúla felt the brunt of it. They were at the worst age, their 13th year, and so wild and willful that Kristen often wondered in utter despair whether any mother in Norway had ever given birth to such rogues. They were handsome, as all her children were, with black, silky, soft, and curly hair, blue eyes beneath black brows, and lean, finely shaped faces. They were quite tall for their age, but still narrow-shouldered, with long, spare limbs. Their joints stood out like knots on a sprig of grain. They looked so much alike that no one outside their home could tell them apart. And in the countryside, people called them the Urengard Swords, but it wasn't meant as a title of honor. Simon had first given them this name in jest because Erland had presented each of them with a sword, and they never let these small swords out of their grasp except when they were in church. Kristen wasn't pleased with this gift, or with the fact that they were always rushing around with axes, spears, and bows. She feared it would land these hot-tempered boys in some kind of trouble. But Erland said curtly that they were old enough now to become accustomed to carrying weapons. She lived in constant fear for these twin sons of hers. When she didn't know where they were, she would secretly wring her hands and implore the Virgin Mary and Saint Olaf to lead them back home, alive and unharmed. They went through mountain passes and up steep cliffs where no one had ever traveled before. They plundered eagles' nests and came home with hideous yellow-eyed fledglings hissing inside their tunics. They climbed along the boulders along the log and north in the gorge where the river plunged from one waterfall to the next. Once Ivar was nearly dragged to his death by his stirrups. He was trying to ride a half-tame young stallion, and God only knew how the boys had managed to put a saddle on the animal. And by chance, out of simple curiosity, they had ventured into the Finn's hut in Toldstad Forest. They had learned a few words of the Sami language from their father, and when they used them to greet the Finnish witch, she welcomed them with food and drink. They had eaten until they were bursting, even though it was a fast day. Kristen had always strictly enjoined that when the grown-ups were fasting, the children should make do with a small portion of food they didn't care for. It was what her own parents had accustomed her to when she was a child. For once, Erland also took his son sternly to task. He burned all the tidbits that the Finnish woman had given the boys as provisions, and he strictly forbade them ever to approach even the outskirts of the woods where the Finns lived. And yet it amused him to hear about the boys' adventure. Later he would often tell Ivar and Skula about his travels up north and what he had observed of the ways of those people. And he would talk to the boys in that ugly and heathen language of theirs. Otherwise, Erland almost never chastised his children. And whenever Kristen complained about the wild behavior of the twins, Erland would dismiss it with a jest. At home on the estate, they got into a great deal of mischief. Although they could make themselves useful if they had to, they weren't clumsy-handed like Nokva. But occasionally, when their mother had given them some chore to do, and she went out to see how it was going, she would find the tools lying on the ground, and the boys would be watching their father, who might be showing them how seafaring men tied knots. When Lavrans Björgolfsson painted tar crosses over the door, to the livestock stalls or in other such places, he used to add a few flourishes with the brush, drawing a circle around the cross, or painting a stroke through each of its arms. One day, the twins decided to use one of these old crosses as a target. Kristen was beside herself with fury and despair at such unchristian behavior. But Erland came to the children's defense. They were so young. They shouldn't be expected to think about the holiness of the cross every time they saw it painted above the door of a shed or on the back of a cow. The boys would be told to go up to the cross on the church hill, kneel down, and kiss it, as they said 5 Paternosters and 15 Ave Marias. It wasn't necessary to call in Sira Solmun for such a reason. But this time Kristen had the support of Björgulf and Nokva. The priest was summoned, and he sprinkled holy water on the wall and reprimanded the 2 young sinners with great severity. They fed oxen and goats the heads of snakes to make them more vicious. They teased Munan because he was still clinging to his mother's skirts, and Gauta because he was the one they fought with most often. Otherwise, the sons of Erland stuck together with the greatest brotherly affection. But sometimes Gauta would give them a thrashing if they were too rough. Trying to talk some sense into them was like talking to a wall. And if their mother grew angry, they would stand there stiffly, their fists clenched, as they scowled at her with flashing eyes beneath frowning brows, their faces fiery red with rage. Kristen thought about what Gunnulf had said about Erland. He had flung his knife at their father and raised his hand against him many times when he was a child. Then she would strike the twins, and strike them hard, because she was frightened. How would things end up for these children of hers if they weren't tamed in time? Simon Dara was the only one who had ever had any power over the 2 wild boys. They loved their uncle, and they always complied whenever he chided them, in a friendly and calm manner. But now that they didn't see him anymore, Kristen hadn't noticed that they missed him. Dejected, she thought how faithless a child's heart could be. But secretly, in her own heart, she knew that she was actually proudest of these 2. If only she could break their terrible, defiant, and wild behavior, she thought that none of their brothers would make more promising men than they would. They were healthy, with good physical abilities. They were fearless, honest, generous, and kind toward all the poor. And more than once they had shown an alacrity and resourcefulness that seemed to her far beyond what might be expected of such young boys. One evening during the hay harvesting, Kristen was up late in the cookhouse when Munan came rushing in, screaming that the old goat shed was on fire. There were no men at home on the manor. Some were in the smithy, sharpening their scythes. Some had gone north to the bridge where the young people usually gathered on summer evenings. Kristen grabbed a couple of buckets and set off running, calling to her maids to follow her. The goat shed was a little old building with a roof that reached all the way down to the ground. It stood in the narrow passageway between the farmyard and the courtyard of the estate, right across from the stable and with other houses built close on either side. Kristen ran onto the gallery of the hearth house and found a broadaxe and a fire hook. But as she rounded the corner of the stable, she didn't see any fire, just a cloud of smoke billowing out of a hole in the roof of the goat shed. Ivar was sitting up on the ridge, hacking at the roof. Skula and Lavrans were inside, pulling down patches of the thatching and then stomping and trampling out the fire. Now they were joined by Erland, Ulf, and the men who had been in the smithy. Munan had run over to warn them, so the fire was put out in short order. And yet the most terrible of misfortunes might easily have occurred. It was a sultry, still evening, but with occasional gusts of wind from the south, and if the fire had engulfed the goat shed, all the buildings at the north end of the courtyard, the stable, storerooms, and living quarters, would certainly have burned with it. Ivar and Skula had been up on the stable roof. They had snared a hawk and were going to hang it from the gable when they caught a whiff of fire and saw smoke coming from the roof below them. They leaped to the ground at once, and with the small axes they were carrying, they began chopping at the smoldering sod while they sent off Lavrans and Munan, who were playing nearby, one to find hooks and the other to get their mother. Fortunately, the rafters and beams in the roof were quite rotten, but it was clear that this time the twins had saved their mother's estate by instantly setting about tearing down the burning roof and not wasting time by first running to get help from the grown-ups. It was hard to understand how the fire had started, except that Gauta had passed that way an hour before, carrying embers to the smithy, and he admitted that the container had not been covered. A spark had probably flown up onto the tinder dry sod roof. But less was said about this than about the quick-wittedness of the twins and Lavrans when Ulf later imposed a fire watch and all the servants kept him company during the night while Kristen had strong ale and mead carried out to them. All three boys had been singed on their hands and feet. Their shoes were so burned that they split into pieces. Young Lavrans was only 9 years old, so it was hard for him to bear the pain patiently for very long. But from the start he was the proudest of the lot, walking around with his hands wrapped up and taking in the praise of the manor servants. That night Erland took his wife in his arms. "My Kristen, my Kristen, don't complain so much about your children. Can't you see, my dear, what good breeding there is in our sons? You always treat these two hardy boys as if you thought their path would lead between the gallows and the execution block. Now it seems to me that you should enjoy some pleasure after all the pain and suffering and toil you've borne through all the years when you constantly carried a child under your belt, with another child at your breast and one on your arm. Back then you would talk of nothing else but those little imps, and now that they've grown up to be both sensible and manly, you walk among them as if you were deaf and dumb, hardly even answering when they speak to you. God help me. But it's as if you love them less now that you no longer have to worry for their sake, and these big, handsome sons of ours can give you both help and joy." Kristen didn't trust herself to answer with a single word. But she lay in bed, unable to sleep. And toward morning she carefully stepped over her slumbering husband and walked barefoot over to the shuttered peephole, which she opened. The sky was a hazy gray, and the air was cool. Far off to the south, where the mountains merged and closed off the valley, rain was sweeping over the plateaus. Kristen stood there for a moment, looking out. It was always so hot and stuffy in this loft above the new storeroom where they slept in the summertime. The trace of moisture in the air brought the strong, sweet scent of hay to her. Outside, a bird or two chittered faintly in their sleep in the summer night. Kristen rummaged around for her flint and lit a candle stump. She crept over to where Ivar and Skula were sleeping on a bench. She shone the light on them and touched their cheeks with the back of her hand. They both had a slight fever. Softly she said an Ave Maria and made the sign of the cross over them. The gallows and the execution block. To think that Erland could jest about such things. He, who had come so close. Lavrans whimpered and murmured in his sleep. Kristen stood bending over her two youngest sons, who were bedded down on a small bench at the foot of their parents' bed. Lavrans was hot and flushed and tossed back and forth, but did not wake up when she touched him. Gauta lay with his milk-white arms behind his head, under his long flaxen hair. He had thrown off all the bedclothes. He was so hot-blooded that he always slept naked, and his skin was such a dazzling white. The tan color of his face, neck, and hands stood out in sharp contrast. Kristen pulled the blanket up around his waist. It was difficult for her to be angry with Gauta. He looked so much like her father. She hadn't said much to him about the calamity he had nearly brought upon them. As clever and level-headed as the boy was, she thought that doubtless he would learn from the incident and not forget it. Nokva and Björgulf slept in the other bed up in the loft. Kristen stood there longer, shining the light on the two sleeping young men. Black down already shadowed their childish soft pink lips. Nokva's foot was sticking out from the covers, slender, with a high instep, a deep arch over the sole, and not very clean. And yet, she thought, it wasn't long ago that the foot of this man was so small that she could wrap her fingers around it, and she had crushed it to her breast and raised it to her lips, nibbling on each tiny toe, for they were as rosy and sweet as the blossoms on a bilberry twig. It was probably true that she didn't pay enough heed to what God had granted her as her lot. The memory of those days when she was carrying Nokva and the visions of terror she had wrestled with, it could pass with fiery heat through her soul. She had been delivered the way a person wakes up to the blessed light of day after terrifying dreams with the oppressive weight of the mare on her breast. But other women had awakened to see that the unhappiness of the day was worse than the very worst they had dreamed. And yet, whenever she saw a cripple or someone who was deformed, Kristen would feel heartsick at the reminder of her own fear for her unborn child. Then she would humble herself before God and Holy Olav with a burning fervor. She would hasten to do good, striving to force tears of true remorse from her eyes as she prayed. But each time she would feel that unthawed discontent in her heart, the fresh surge would cool, and the sobs would seep out of her soul like water in sand. Then she consoled herself that she didn't have the gift of piety she had once hoped would be her inheritance from her father. She was hard and sinful, but surely she was no worse than most people. And like most people, she would have to bear the fiery blaze of that other world before her heart could be melted and cleansed. And yet sometimes she longed to be different. When she looked at the seven handsome sons sitting at her table, or when she made her way up to church on Sabbath mornings as the bells tolled, calling so agreeably to joy and God's peace, and she saw the flock of straight-backed, well-dressed young boys, her sons, climbing the hillside ahead of her. She didn't know of any other woman who had given birth to so many children and had never experienced what it was like to lose one. All of them were handsome and healthy, without a flaw in their physical or mental capacities, although Björgulf's sight was poor. She wished she could forget her sorrows and be gentle and graceful, fearing and loving God as her father had done. She remembered her father had said that the person who recalls his sins with a humble spirit and bows before the cross of the Lord need never bow his head beneath any earthly unhappiness or injustice. Kristen blew out the candle, pinched the wick, and returned the stump to its place between the uppermost logs in the wall. She went back over to the peephole. It was already daylight outside, but gray and dead. On the lower rooftops, upon which she gazed, the dirty, sun-bleached grass stirred faintly from a gust of wind. A little rustling sound passed through the leaves of the birches across from the roof of the high loft building. She looked down at her hands, holding on to the sill of the peephole. They were rough and worn. Her arms were tanned all the way up to her elbows, and her muscles were swollen and as hard as wood. In her youth, the children had sucked the blood and milk from her until every trace of maidenly smoothness and fresh plumpness had been sapped from her body. Now each day of toil stripped away a little more of the remnants of beauty that had distinguished her as the daughter, wife, and mother of men with noble blood. The slender white hands, the pale soft arms, the fair complexion, which she had carefully shielded from sunburn with linen kerchiefs and protected with specially brewed cleansing concoctions. She had long ago grown indifferent to whether the sun shone directly on her face, sweaty from work, and turned it as brown as that of a poor peasant woman. Her hair was the only thing she had left of her girlish beauty. It was just as luxuriant and brown, even though she seldom found time to wash or tend to it. The heavy, tangled braid that hung down her back hadn't been undone in 3 days. Kristen pulled it forward over her shoulder, undid the plait, and shook out her hair, which still enveloped her like a cloak and reached below her knees. She took a comb from her chest, and shivering now and then, she sat in her shift beneath the peephole, open to the coolness of the morning, and gently combed out her tangled tresses. When she was done with her hair and had rebraided it in a tight, heavy rope, she felt a little better. Then she cautiously lifted the sleeping Munan into her arms, placed him next to the wall in her husband's bed, and then crawled in between them. She held her youngest child in her arms, rested his head against her shoulder, and fell asleep. She slept late the next morning. Erland and the boys were already up when she awakened.
"I think you've been suckling at your mother's breast when nobody's looking," said Erland when he saw Munan lying next to his mother.
The boy grew cross, ran outside, and crept across the gallery, out onto a carved beam atop the posts holding up the gallery. He would prove he was a man.
"Run!"
shouted Nokva from down in the courtyard. He caught his little brother in his arms, turned him upside down, and tossed him to Björgulf. The two older boys wrestled with him until he was laughing and shrieking at the same time. But the following day, when Munan cried because his fingers had been stung by the recoil of the bowstring, the twins rolled him up in a coverlet and carried him over to their mother's bed. In his mouth, they stuffed a piece of bread so big that the boy nearly choked. Chapter 2. Erland's house priest at Husaby had taught his three oldest sons their lessons. They were not very diligent pupils, but all three learned quickly, and their mother, who had been raised with this kind of book learning, kept an eye on them so that the knowledge they gained was not altogether paltry. During the year that Björgulf and Nokva spent with Sira Eiliv at the monastery on Tautra, they had eagerly suckled at the breasts of Lady Wisdom, as the priest expressed it. Their teacher was an exceedingly old monk who had devoted his life with the zeal of a bee to gleaning knowledge from all the books he came across, both in Latin and in Old Norse. Sira Eiliv was himself a lover of wisdom, but during his years at Husaby, he had had little opportunity to follow his inclination for bookish pursuits. For him, the time spent with Aslak, the teacher, was like pasture grazing for starved cattle. And the two young boys, who kept close to their own priest while staying with the monks, followed the learned conversations of the men with their mouths agape. Then Brother Aslak and Sira Eiliv found joy in feeding these two young minds with the most delectable honey from the monastery's book treasures, which Brother Aslak had supplemented with many copied versions and excerpts of the most magnificent books. Soon the boys grew so clever that the monk seldom had to speak to them in Norwegian, and when their parents came to get them, both could answer the priest in Latin, fluently and correctly. Afterward, the brothers kept up what they had learned. There were many books at Jurengard. Lavrans had owned 5. 2 of them had been inherited by Romborg when his estate was settled, but she had never wanted to learn to read, and Simon was not so practiced with written words that he had any desire to read for his own amusement, although he could decipher a letter and compose one himself. So he asked Kristen to keep the books until his children were older. After they were married, Erlund gave Kristen three books that had belonged to his parents. She had received another book as a gift from Gunolf Nicolassen. He had had it copied for his brother's wife from a book about Holy Olav and his miracles, several other saint legends, and the missive the Franciscan monks of Oslo had sent to the Pope about Brother Edvin Rikardsen, seeking to have him recognized as a saint. And finally, Nokva had been given a prayer book by Sira Eiliv when they parted. Nokva often read to his brother. He read fluently and well, with a slight lilt to his voice, the way Brother Aslak had taught him. He was most fond of the books in Latin, his own prayer book and one that had belonged to Lavrans Björgulsson. But his greatest treasure was a big, exceptionally splendid book that had been part of the family inheritance ever since the days of the ancestor who was his namesake, Bishop Nicolaus Arneson. Kristen wanted her younger sons also to acquire learning that would be fitting for men of their birth, but it was difficult to know how this might be done. Sira Eirik was much too old, and Sira Solmund could read only from those books that he used for the church service. Much of what he read he didn't fully understand. On some evenings, Lavrans found it amusing to sit with Nokva and let his brother show him how to form the letters on his wax tablet, but the other three had absolutely no desire to learn such skills. One day, Kristen took out a Norwegian book and asked Gaute to see if he could remember anything of what he had learned in his childhood from Sira Eiliv. But Gaute couldn't even manage to spell his way through three words, and when he came across the first symbol that stood for several letters, he closed the book with a laugh and said he didn't feel like playing that game anymore. This was the reason that Sira Solmund came over to Jurengard one evening late in the summer and asked Nicolaus to accompany him home. A foreign knight had come from the feast of St. Olav in Nidaros and taken lodgings at Romengard, but he spoke no Norwegian. Nor did his soldiers or servants, while the guide who was escorting them spoke only a few words of their language. Sira Eirik was ill in bed. Could Nokva come over and speak to the man in Latin? Nokva was not at all displeased to be asked to act as interpreter, but he feigned nonchalance and went with the priest. He returned home very late, in high spirits and quite drunk. He had been given wine, which the foreign knight had brought along and liberally poured for the priest and the deacon and Nokva. His name was something like Sir Alland or Alert of Bekalar. He was from Flanders and was making a pilgrimage to various holy shrines in the northern countries. He was exceedingly friendly, and it had been no trouble to talk to him. Then Nokva mentioned his request. From there the knight was headed for Oslo, and then on to pilgrim sites in Denmark and Germany, and now he wanted Nokva to come with him to be his interpreter, at least while he was in Norway. But he had also hinted that if the youth should accompany him out into the world, then Sir Alart was the man who could make his fortune. Where he came from, it seemed as if golden spurs and necklaces, heavy money pouches, and splendid weapons were simply waiting for a man like young Nicolaus Erlandsen to come along and take them. Nokva had replied that he was not yet of age and would need permission from his father. But Sir Alert had still pressed a gift upon him. He had expressly stated that it would in no way bind him, a knee-length plum-blue silk tunic with silver bells on the points of the sleeves. Erlund listened to him, saying hardly a word, with an oddly tense expression on his face. When Nokva was finished, he sent Gaute to get the chest with his writing implements, and at once set about composing a letter in Latin. Björgulf had to help him, because Nokva was in no condition to do much of anything, and his father had sent him off to bed. In the letter, Erlund invited the knight to his home on the following day, after prime, so they might discuss Sir Alert's offer to take the noble-born young man, Nicolaus Erlandsen, into his service as his esquire. He asked the knight's forgiveness for returning his gift, with the plea that Sir Alert might keep it until Nicolaus, with his father's consent, had been sworn into the man's service in accordance with such customs as prevailed among knights in all the lands. Erlon dripped a little wax on the bottom of the letter and lightly pressed his small seal, the one on his ring, into it. Then he sent a servant boy off to Romengard at once with the letter and the silk tunic.
"Husband, surely you can't be thinking of sending your young son off to distant lands with an unknown foreigner," said Kristen, shivering.
"We shall see."
Erlon smiled quite strangely.
"But I don't think it's likely," he added when he noticed her distress.
He smiled again and caressed her cheek. At Erlon's request, Kristen had strewn the floor in the high loft with juniper and flowers, placed the best cushions on the benches, and set the table with a linen cloth and good food and drink in fine dishes and the precious silver-chased animal horns they had inherited from Lavrans. Erlon had shaved carefully, curled his hair, and dressed in a black, richly embroidered ankle-length robe made of foreign cloth. He went to meet his guest at the manor gate, and as they crossed the courtyard together, Kristen couldn't help thinking that her husband looked more like the French knights mentioned in the sagas than did the fat, fair-haired stranger in the colorful and resplendent garments made from velvet and sarsenet. She stood on the gallery of the high loft, beautifully attired and wearing a silk wimple. The Flemish man kissed her hand as she bade him bienvenue. She didn't exchange another word with him during all the hours he spent with them. She understood nothing of the men's conversation, nor did Sira Solmun, who had come with his guest. But the priest told the mistress that now he had assuredly made Nokva's fortune. She neither agreed nor disagreed with him. Erlon spoke a little French and could fluently speak the kind of German that mercenaries spoke. The discussion between him and the foreign knight flowed easily and courteously. But Kristen noticed that the Flemish man did not seem pleased as things progressed, although he strove to conceal his displeasure. Erlon had told his sons to wait over in the loft of the new storehouse until he sent word for them to join them, but they were not sent for. Erlon and his wife escorted the knight and the priest to the gate. When their guests disappeared among the fields, Erlon turned to Kristen and said with that smile she found so distasteful, "I wouldn't let Nokva leave the estate with that fellow, even to go south to Brighton." Ulf Haldorsson came over to them. He and Erlon spoke a few words that Kristen couldn't hear, but Ulf swore fiercely and spat. Erlon laughed and slapped the man on the shoulder. "Yes, if I'd been such a country dolt as the good farmers around here. But I've seen enough that I wouldn't let my fair young falcons out of my hands by selling them to the devil. Sira Solmun had no idea, that blessed fool." Kristen stood with her arms hanging at her sides, the color ebbing and rising in her face. Horror and shame overcame her, making her feel sick. Her legs seemed to lose all strength. She had known about such things, as something endlessly remote, but that this unmentionable might venture as close as her own doorstep. It was like the last wave, threatening to overturn her storm-tossed, overloaded boat. Holy Mary, did she also need to fear that for her sons? Erlon said with the same loathsome smile,
"I already had my doubts last night. Sir Allard seemed to me a little too chivalrous from Nokva's account. I know that it's not the custom among knights anywhere in the world to welcome a man who is to be taken into service by kissing him on the lips or by giving him costly presents before seeing proof of his abilities."
Shaking from head to toe, Kristen said, "Why did you ask me to strew the floor with roses and cover my table with linen cloths for such a..." And she uttered the worst of words. Erlon frowned. He had picked up a stone and was keeping an eye on Munon's red cat, which was slithering on its stomach through the tall grass along the wall of the house, heading for the chickens near the stable door. Whoosh! He threw the stone. The cat streaked around the corner, and the flock of hens scattered. He turned to face his wife.
"I thought I could at least have a look at the man. If he had been a trustworthy fellow, then..." But in that case, I had to show the proper courtesy. I'm not Sir Allard's confessor. And you heard that he's planning to go to Oslo.
Erland laughed again. Now it's possible that some of my true friends and dear kinsmen from the past may hear that we're not sitting up here at Jorungard shaking the lice from our rags or eating herring and oat lefse.
Björgulf had a headache and was lying in bed when Kristin came up to the loft at supper time, and Nokfa said he didn't want to go over to the main house for the evening meal.
You seem to me morose tonight, son, said his mother.
How can you think that, mother? Said Nokfa with a scornful smile. The fact that I'm a worse fool than other men, and it's easier to throw sand in my eyes. Surely that's nothing to be morose about. Console yourself, said his father, as they sat down at the table, and Nokfa was still too quiet. No doubt you'll go out into the world and have a chance to try your luck.
That depends, father, replied Nokfa in a low voice, as if he intended only Erland to hear him.
Whether Björgulf can go with me.
Then he laughed softly.
But talk to Ivar and Skúla about what you just said. They're merely waiting to reach the proper age before they set off.
Kristin stood up and put on her hooded cloak. She was going to go north to tend to the beggar at Ingebjörg's hut, she told them when they asked. The twins offered to go along and carry her sack, but she wanted to go alone. The evenings were already quite dark, and north of the church the path passed through the woods and beneath the shadow of Hamr Ridge. There gusts of cold wind always issued from Roast Gorge, and the din of the river brought a trace of moisture to the air. Swarms of big white moths hovered and flitted under the trees, sometimes flying straight at her. The pale glow of the linen around her face and on her breast seemed to draw them in the dark. She swatted them away with her hand as she rushed upward, sliding on the slippery carpet of needles and stumbling over the writhing roots that sprawled across the path she was following. A certain dream had haunted Kristin for many years. The first time she had it was on the night before Gauta was born. But occasionally she would still wake up, soaked with sweat, her heart hammering as if it would shatter in her chest, and she had dreamed the same thing. She saw a meadow with flowers, a steep hill deep inside a pine forest that bordered the mound on three sides, dark and dense. At the foot of the slope, a small lake mirrored the dim forest and the dappled green of the clearing. The sun was behind the trees. At the top of the hill, the last long golden rays of evening light filtered through the boughs, and at the bottom of the lake, sun-touched gleaming clouds swam among the leaves of water lilies. Halfway up the slope, standing deep in the avalanche of alpine catchflies and globe flowers, and the pale green clouds of angelica, she saw her child. It must have been Nokfa the first time she had the dream. Back then she had only two, and Björgulf was still in the cradle. Later, she was never certain which of her children it might be. The little round sunburned face under the fringe of yellow-brown hair seemed to her to resemble first one and then another of her sons. But the child was always between 2 and 3 years old, and dressed in the kind of small, dark yellow tunic that she usually sewed for her little boys as everyday attire, from homespun wool, dyed with lichen, and trimmed with red ribbon. Sometimes she seemed to be on the other side of the lake. Or she might not be present at all when it happened. And yet she saw everything. She saw her little son moving about, here and there, turning his face as he tugged at the flowers. And even though her heart felt the clutch of a dull anguish, a premonition of the evil about to occur, the dream always brought with it first a powerful, aching sweetness as she gazed at the lovely child there in the meadow. Then she sees emerging from the darkness at the edge of the woods a furry bulk that is alive. It moves soundlessly, its tiny, vicious eyes smoldering. The bear reaches the top of the meadow and stands there, its head and shoulders swaying as it considers the slope. Then it leaps.
Kristen had never seen a bear alive, but she knew bears didn't leap that way. This is not a real bear. It runs like a cat, and at the same moment it turns gray, and like a giant light-colored cat it flies with long, soft strides down the hill. The mother is deathly frightened, but she can't reach the child to protect him. She can't make a sound of warning. Then the boy notices that something is there. He turns halfway and looks over his shoulder. With a horrifying, low-pitched cry of terror, he tries to run downhill, lifting his legs high in the tall grass the way children do. And his mother hears the tiny crack of sap-filled stalks breaking as he runs through the profusion of blossoms. Now he stumbles over something in the grass, falls headlong, and in the next instant, the beast is upon him with its back arched and its head lowered between its front paws. Then she wakes up. And each time she would lie awake for hours before her attempts to reassure herself did any good. It was only a dream after all. She would draw into her arms her smallest child, who lay between herself and the wall, thinking that if it had been real, she could have done such and such, scared off the animal with a shriek or with a pole. And there was always the long, sharp knife that hung from her belt. But just as she had convinced herself in this manner to calm down, it would seize hold of her once again, the unbearable anguish of her dream as she stood powerless and watched her little son's pitiful, hopeless flight from the strong, ruthlessly swift, and hideous beast. Her blood felt as if it were boiling inside her, foaming so that it made her body swell, and her heart was about to burst, for it couldn't contain such a violent surge of blood. Ingebjörg's hut lay up on Hammer Ridge, a short distance below the main road that led up to the heights. It had stood empty for many years, and the land had been leased to a man who had been allowed to clear space for a house nearby. An ill beggar who had been left behind by a procession of mendicants had now taken refuge inside. Kristen had sent food and clothing and medicine up to him when she heard of this, but she hadn't had time to visit him until now. She saw that the poor man's life would soon be over. Kristen gave her sack to the beggar woman who was staying with him and then tended to the ill man, doing what little she could. When she heard that they had sent for the priest, she washed his face, hands, and feet so they would be clean to receive the last anointment. The air was thick with smoke, and a terribly oppressive, foul smell filled the tiny room. When two women from the neighboring household came in, Kristen asked them to send word to Jorungard for anything they might need. Then she bade them farewell and left. She suddenly had a strange, sick fear of meeting the priest with the Corpus Domini, so she took the first side path she encountered. It was merely a cattle track, she soon realized, and it led her right into the wilderness. The fallen trees with their tangle of roots sticking up frightened her. She had to crawl over them in those places where she couldn't make her way around. Layers of moss slid out from under her feet when she clambered down over large rocks. Spider webs clung to her face, and branches swung at her and caught on her clothes. When she had to cross a small creek, or she came to a marshy clearing in the woods, it was almost impossible to find a place where she could slip through the dense, wet thickets of leafy shrubs. And the loathsome white moths were everywhere, teeming beneath the trees in the darkness, swarming up in great clouds from the heath-covered mounds when she trod on them. But at last she reached the flat rocks down by the Logue River. Here the pine forest thinned out because the trees had to twine their roots over barren rocks, and the forest floor was almost nothing but dry, grayish-white reindeer moss, which crackled under her feet. Here and there a black heath-covered mound was visible. The fragrance of pine needles was hotter and drier and sharper than higher up. Here all the branches of the trees always looked yellow-scorched from early spring on. The white moths continued to plague her. The roar of the river drew her. She walked all the way over to the edge and looked down. Far below, the water shimmered white as it seethed and thundered over the rocks from one pool to the next. The monotonous drone of the waterfalls resonated through her overwrought body and soul. It kept reminding her of something. Of a time that was an eternity ago, even back when she realized that she would not have the strength to bear the fate she had chosen for herself. She had laid bare her protected, gentle girl's life to a ravaging, fleshly love. She had lived in anguish, anguish, anguish ever since. An unfree woman from the first moment she became a mother. She had given herself up to the world in her youth, and the more she squirmed and struggled against the bonds of the world, the more fiercely she felt herself imprisoned and fettered by them. She struggled to protect her sons with wings that were bound by the constraints of earthly care. She had striven to conceal her anguish and her inexpressible weakness from everyone. Walking forward with her back erect and her face calm, holding her tongue, and fighting to ensure the welfare of her children in any way she could. But always with that secret, breathless anguish, if things go badly for them, I won't be able to bear it. And deep in her heart, she wailed at the memory of her father and mother. They had borne anguish and sorrow over their children day after day until their deaths. They had been able to carry this burden, and it was not because they loved their children any less, but because they loved with a better kind of love. Was this how she would see her struggle end? Had she conceived in her womb a flock of restless, fledgling hawks that simply lay in her nest, waiting impatiently for the hour when their wings were strong enough to carry them beyond the most distant blue peaks? And their father would clap his hands and laugh. Fly, fly, my young birds. They would take with them bloody threads from the roots of her heart when they flew off, and they wouldn't even know it. She would be left behind alone, and all the heartstrings, which had once bound her to this old home of hers, she had already sundered. That was how it would end, and she would be neither alive nor dead. She turned on her heel, stumbling hastily across the pale, parched carpet of reindeer moss, with her cloak pulled tight around her because it was so unpleasant when it caught on the branches. At last she emerged onto the sparse meadow plains that lay slightly north of the farmer's banquet hall and the church. As she cut across the field, she caught sight of someone in the road. He called out, "Is that you, Kristen?" And she recognized her husband. "You were gone a long time," said Erlan. "It's almost night, Kristen. I was starting to grow frightened." "Were you frightened for me?" Her voice sounded more harsh and haughty than she had intended.
"Well, not exactly frightened. But I thought I would come out to meet you."
They barely spoke as they walked southward. All was quiet when they entered the courtyard. Some of the horses they kept on the manor were slowly moving along the walls of the main house, grazing, but all the servants had gone to bed. Erland headed straight for the storeroom loft, but Kristen turned toward the cookhouse. "I have to see to something," she replied to his query. He stood leaning over the gallery railing, waiting for his wife. When he saw her come out of the cookhouse with the pine torch in her hand and go over to the hearth house, Erland waited a moment and then ran down and followed her inside. She had lit a candle and placed it on the table. Erland felt an odd, cold shiver of fear pass through him when he saw her standing there with a lone candle in the empty house. Only the built-in furniture remained in the room, and the glow of the flame shimmered over the worn wood, unadorned and bare. The hearth was cold and swept clean, except for the torch, which had been tossed into it, still smoldering. They never used this building, Erland and Kristen, and it must have been almost half a year since a fire had been lit inside. The air was strangely oppressive. Missing was the vital blend of smells from people living there and coming and going. The smoke vent and doors had not been opened in all that time. The place also smelled of wool and hides. Several rolled-up skins and sacks, which Kristen had taken from among the goods in the storeroom, were piled up on the empty bed that had belonged to Lavrans and Ronfrid. On the table lay a heap of small skeins of thread and yarn, linen and wool to be used for mending, which Kristen had set aside when she did the dyeing. She was going through them now, setting them in order. Erlan sat down in the high seat at the end of the table. It seemed oddly